Hello, educators and learners, and welcome to the Homeroom with Sal podcast, brought to you by Khan Academy. We're an educational technology nonprofit dedicated to bringing a world-class education to anyone, anywhere, and Sal is our founder. I'm not Sal Khan, I'm David Reinstrom. I'm on the content team, and I'm here to introduce today's show. Sal, or the occasional guest host, presents the Homeroom with Sal and Khan Academy Ed Talks live stream shows on YouTube and Facebook, where they interview notable folks from the worlds of education, technology, finance, entertainment, and more. We've taken some of our favorite conversations from the live show and turned them into a podcast. Without further ado, here's this week's show.
Now, with that, I'm very excited to introduce our guest today for many, many different reasons. Anant Agarwal is the CEO and really the founder of edX. He's a co-member of the Yidan Council of Luminaries. He is a winner of the Yidan Prize in Education. But maybe what most people don't realize is that you were my professor in college. You were my recitation instructor. I believe it was in either in circuits or signals and systems. You might remember better.
I think it was in circuits and electronics. You know, as they say, this is the one case where I think the professor has learned a lot more from his student than the other way around.
Oh, I know so much about circuits. Professor Agarwal.
Okay. All right. I'm going to ask you my first question.
I mean, in all fairness, my degree is computer science and electrical engineering. It's much more computer science. And my wife rolls her eyes because one would assume with an electrical engineering degree, I would be able to be more handy around the house. But I explain I'm very theoretical and I'm afraid of electrocuting myself or others. So I turn to professional, but give me some software and I could definitely go to town with that. Before we go into what you do now, I'm sure you remembered me when I was your student, you know, in the sea of bright faces, you're like that kid.
I had you pegged. When I saw the face, I said, this person is going to be one of the world's greatest luminaries in terms of teaching and learning. I had you pegged. When you went off into financial systems and so on, that was a total surprise. But what you're doing now, you know, I had you pegged, buddy.
Well, I will take that for what it's worth. I'm pretty much sure that you don't remember me, and I was just a face in the crowd. But let's go into what you now do. So for anyone who's been living under a rock for the past 10 or so years, what is edX?
edX is a learning platform where we connect some of the teachers and professors from the greatest institutions in the world, like MIT and Harvard, Stanford, Berkeley, Oxford, and others, to learners from all over the world. So it's a platform where learners who want to learn can come in and learn from some of the best professors and teachers around the world, and also from companies like Amazon Web Services, Google, IBM, and others. We have about 40 million learners on our platform where learners come in and they can learn anything from the humanities to computer science to data science, business, arts. You can even learn how to use mechanical ventilators, a course that we launched with Harvard and MGH during COVID times about a year ago. And people can also earn credentials. We have these modular credentials like MicroMasters and MicroBachelors that people can use to upskill in their current job. Or if you've been furloughed, you can use that to gain new skills for the future. So this is who edX is, and you can come in and you can start learning. You can learn for free on the platform.
And give us a little background. How did all of this come to be? What, you know, you were a professor, a very successful professor at MIT. You had your tenure. You were running departments. You kind of gave that up to do this. What was the evolution of going from professor to edX and making this your life?
You know, Sal, you had something to do with it. I would trace it back to, so for me, education has always been something near and dear to my heart. I remember as a physics student at IIT Madras in my first year, I was one of two students out of 300 that failed the first physics exam, and my, you know, heart completely stopped. And, you know, at that time, I realized that everybody around me seemed to understand calculus-based physics. There was no Khan Academy then, remember? And I was here, I hadn't learned calculus-based physics, and I had no idea what they were talking about. And so, you know, I said, look, you know, hopefully there'll be one day when everybody will have equal access to education and come up to speed as everybody else. I really got a chance in the year 2000 when MIT launched OpenCourseWare. I was one of the early professors to launch my circuits course on OpenCourseWare. And then, you know, Sal, I've heard you talk about how you were inspired by OpenCourseWare and you launched Khan Academy. And, you know, I heard about your videos from my children and others. And, you know, at MIT, a number of us were thinking about what should the future look like. We did OpenCourseWare. What would the next big thing look like? And then as a confluence of multiple technologies happened around 2008, 2009, like social networking, video distribution at scale, cloud computing, mobile computing, you know, at that time, it was very clear that we could do learning at scale. And I launched a program called WebSim as part of our lab, where I said, if I could teach people how to do circuits labs fully online, then maybe this is something we could do at scale. And so on the average day, 200 to 300 students from all over the world would come in and do WebSim, which is, think of it as a MOOC lab. And this was, I built it out in 2003. And this was
MOOC, you know, being massively open before massively open online courses existed.
Oh, this was, you know, 9 years before they existed, 2003. So you could maybe call it a MOOL, massive open online labs. It was circuits labs. And I figured if I could do online circuits labs, then maybe I could do you know, other things. But then I did nothing beyond that. I just kept running the WebSim. And then inspired by you, Sal, in 2011, a number of us at MIT got together, the leadership at MIT, Rafael Reif, myself, leadership at Harvard, Alan Garber, and others, began thinking about how could we take this to the next level. And that's how edX was born, where we said, look, rather than just having course materials as in OpenCourseWare, why don't we take complete courses with certificates, with communities, and also with labs and real hands-on experiences, and make that available to the world. And that's when we launched MITx in December of 2011 and turned into edX when we partnered with Harvard and MIT in early May and launched edX. That's how it all came together.
And what made you decide to make this your life journey? You know, as I said, you had a good gig as a professor, head of departments.
You know what? It's one of those things where, you know, I'm as far as life is concerned, I'm very much an incrementalist. I don't plan very far out, and you know, I sort of take it one base at a time. You know, to use a baseball analogy. And so, when the opportunity arose, we decided we'd create a MOOC platform, and initially called MITx, and then called edX. I was the head of the computer science and AI lab at MIT, and you know, had a 25-strong research group with PhD students and postdocs and undergrads and so on. And so we incubated what would become edX in the basement of CSAIL, the computer science and AI lab at MIT. And I was looking to recruit professors to teach the first course on edX. And when I told people, yeah, the course needs to start in 2 months, and oh, by the way, we are building a completely new platform. We wanted an open source platform that uses Python and Django and the latest technologies and not the old stuff, cloud-based. There's nothing available at that time. And so my colleague said, you're nuts, can't do it. And so, you know, by that time we'd announced edX, there's no one ready to teach something. And so, you know, we'd announced it. And so I jumped in and said, you know, look, we'll launch with the circuits course. And people looked to me as if I was crazy. Why would you launch with a circuits course as opposed to something like machine learning or Python programming? I said, look, that's the best we can do. I could not get my colleagues to do this quickly enough. They felt we were nuts. And so that's how we launched with the circuits course. And I kind of got sucked into it, having to do it, do the first course myself with several of my colleagues, like Jerry Sussman, Jacob White, Chris Turman, and others, who really jumped in and pitched in to make it happen.
No, it's a great story, and I do want to ask where this is all going. Where do you see the future? But I'm getting an unusual number of questions coming in through the message board, so I want to make sure I get to some of these. This is just kind of a fun question from YouTube. Antonine Apuleius, what's your favorite thing in math? And maybe I'll expand Antonine's question a little bit. What's your favorite thing in all of knowledge, in all of learning?
You know, I'll answer both questions. My favorite thing in math actually was when I really, one day I kind of just got it. I really figured out how to solve differential equations, which is that you try not to overthink it. You just kind of do it mechanically and you apply templates and do it. And actually, I remember in my circuits course, we used first and second order differential equations and solutions of those. And I actually called up my student who had this little gig going in California. And I called him up and said, hey, look, you know, I need, your website doesn't have a video tutorial on first order differential equations. So I need you to create something for me. And this guy did it. And his name was Khan Academy. So in my course on edX, I have a tutorial from Sal Khan on some of the stuff. But in terms of, in all of learning, I think the thing, my dream is one day to really understand quantum mechanics. I don't understand it. I've never really gotten it deeply. I can do the math and do some of the formulaic stuff. But my dream one day is to really have the time to sit down and listen to Feynman's lectures and others and really, really, truly, truly grok it. I'm not there yet.
You know, it's interesting. My quantum mechanics. And sorry, are you getting a little buzz every time I talk? Every time I start to talk, it sounds like there's a little. Did you hear that?
No, I'm okay.
Oh, good, 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 good. No, when you mentioned quantum mechanics, that is one of those things that I seek to have a deeper understanding of it. But I think anyone, the first time you learn it, and you say, "Wow, all matter has both particle and wave-like properties," that the electron is a wave until you attempt to observe it, and then it collapses, the wave function collapses, and then you know its position. Like, it's so counterintuitive to what we think is our understanding or our perception of the universe. And actually, I probably had the most interesting insight that affects my understanding of quantum mechanics when I was reading this this question and answer. This is recently. This is with an Indian guru who died in the 1980s. His name is Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj. And he wrote this. Actually, he didn't write this book. This book, I Am That, is based on conversations with him. And you know, he's apparently, you know, had reached nirvana or moksha, or, you know, had kind of reached enlightenment. And people are always asking him these questions. And they keep asking them, well, what is the cause of this? And what is the cause of that? And he says, you are so obsessed with causality. What you call causality is just repeated correlation. And I was like, is he right? Is it just repeated correlation? And I'm still processing that, but that actually in some ways opened my mind to things like quantum mechanics, which seem to defy our standard intuitions, whatever the intuition is, of causality and correlation. But yeah, I think that's really
absolutely. I did have a really, really deep understanding of, Newtonian mechanics and so on. And maybe that was part of the problem. I really deeply got it. And then when you had to completely rethink things and change your frame of reference, you know, it almost became like one of the Yogi Berra quotes, you know, wherever you go, there you are. You said, yeah, I understand that. But when you really think about it deeply, you said, no, I don't got that. I have no idea what that means. And then the deeper I began thinking about, you know, quantum mechanics and things like that, the more I realized that, well, I could do the math and do calculations of speed of light and, you know, the compression, you know, time and all of that stuff and space. I could do the math, but I never really, really internalized and got it. So, you know, my dream one day is to really, really get it.
Yeah, completely agree. And I could go on into this, but like, you know, how much is based on perception? Well, anyway, we could go more into this. Another fun quote from that guru was when someone, you know, he's like, you know, you ascribe reality to certain things and you ascribe imagination or dream like to other things. But imagine if your dreams picked off where they left off the night before, then all of a sudden you would have two realities. Anyway, we're going way off topic. But quantum mechanics makes me think of that.
I think it goes much better with the beer in your hand, actually.
We're not, a lot of kids are watching Professor Agarwal.
You're
a role model. Be careful what you advocate for. So more questions and really good ones. Several from Badri Ratnam on YouTube. So one of the questions is, Dr. Agarwal, India and the third world was hit hard by COVID. In one of your talks, you had mentioned that there's a plan to put the entire medical education curriculum online. How is that progressing?
I did give a talk where we are talking to a number of universities where the idea is, you know, could we put an entire medical curriculum online? And you know, the same applies to computer science, data science, business. And we've been sort of going at it one at a time. We made huge inroads into computer science, data science, and business on edX. We have over 3,000 courses, and we're making great inroads in these areas. I would say healthcare is going to be next, where we do have a fair number of courses at this time. But the idea would be, imagine if you could learn about, you know, topics like biochemistry, biology, you know, epidemiology, you know, pathology, a lot of the theoretical aspects of these subjects. But then you go to college and you learn and you practice, and you know, you work with real cadavers and all of that stuff, and you really, really practice and look at patients and work with patients and sick people. That would be the way to do it. Sort of a blended model of learning where what you could learn online, you sort of learn online, and then you do all the practicum stuff when you come to a physical a medical space. And so to me, that would be something that is very exciting and something that we would be interested in doing in the future. But again, you know, we started with computer science, data science, and business, where we've really built out a pretty deep curricula in those areas.
Yeah, it seems, you and I have definitely talked about this in the past, that the potential for, I mean, medicine is a big one, considering the shortage of healthcare workers around the world. But there's so many fields that I think, you know, between the edX's of the world and the Khan Academies of the world, I think we're actually just at the very early stages. I have another question here, and this is really, you're clearly an educator reaching millions, so there's that hat, but there's also, you used to be the head of the AI lab at MIT, so you know a thing or two, I'm assuming, about that. You know, from YouTube, Saurav Saha asks, what are your thoughts about the future of automation in different fields of technology? And then I'll add to the question is, you know, so, and given your views of where automation and machine learning and robotics are going, where do you see education needing to go, or maybe even leveraging some of those trends?
Oh my God, there's so much we could talk about here. Certainly, the computer science and AI lab at MIT is one of the centers for AI machine learning research. You know, a number of other universities and companies are also where incredible research is happening in AI and machine learning. And you know, much as computing and the internet changed the world in the late 80s, machine learning and AI and automation are completely transforming industry today and in the future. The downside is that people talk about roughly 50% of today's jobs will be transformed into other jobs that will require new sets of skills, where a whole planet, half the planet of people need to be upskilling and reskilling. And that's one of the areas that edX focuses in very heavily, that we offer professional certificates and micromasters and microbachelors and other credentials in these topic areas where people can come in and reskill with short courses and programs and things like machine learning and AI. But certainly we're seeing transformations of industries where in the past, I'll just give you a simple example. Let's say, for example, a translation. You know, when you speak, usually humans would translate what you said into some other language, the UN and so on. You've seen some of these. You've probably seen the movie Interpreter, where, you know, Nicole Kidman was out there, you know, translating in real time what people were saying. Now imagine, I mean, today that this technology is there, where even as you speak, a machine could be translating you into one of any number of languages. And you know, machine learning technology is key to things like this. To your second question, Sal, I think the same thing. Huge impact will happen in the learning field as well. Where, first of all, let me start by saying the teacher is always going to be critical. I think people need to connect with people and get inspired, and you know, they're looking for mentors and so on. And you know, I too had some incredible mentors in my school and college. And I'm hoping we can talk about some of them. But at the same time, machine learning and AI can take over many of the tasks. So for example, I'll give you one example. One of the things we worked on at edX was a tipping framework, where imagine, based on the solutions that people were developing for problems, imagine that you could create a hinting framework where if a student got stuck in a problem, they'd say, okay, give me a hint. And the computer gives them a hint based on all the solutions they've seen in the past. And so there are so many things you could do. Another example is some amazing work that Berkeley did, where they did research using edX learner data, where looking at the progression of learner activity, they could tell when a learner was going to drop out of a course. And so using machine learning. And then based on that, you could actually create interventions and mentorships that happen just at the right time to enable someone to get more motivated and to stay in the course. And these are just two examples. Georgia Tech has done, and IBM have done research in some edX courses where the teaching assistants in the discussion forums, the live teaching assistants have been experimentally, in some cases, replaced by AI technology, where some of the questions were answered, again, using machine learning as a basis for building up the the repertoire of questions on which to train the machine learning model. So I can see many, many areas where a learning and teachers and universities and schools can benefit hugely from AI and machine learning, you know, helping learners, do a lot better. Imagine they, to me, one of the big ones is personalized learning, where imagine if every learner could have a personalized tutor that could teach them, problems in certain areas at their own pace in a way that was completely customized to them. To me, that's one of the big holy grails of teaching and learning.
No, I couldn't agree more these notions of personalization. But I am curious, you know, how do you think this is going to affect, and I agree with you also that this will never replace the teacher, that human connection actually is probably going to become even more important over time as other things get automated. But what do you think this is going to do to labor markets? Are there going to be, you know, there's kind of these techno-optimists who say, well, the Industrial Revolution, yes, a lot of jobs were lost, but a lot of jobs got created. Do you think that's just going to be the same thing? We just have to have some optimistic faith that will happen? Or do we think this time is different because of the nature of the tasks that machine learning and robotics can take on? And if so, yeah, how do we get the positives while mitigating the negatives?
I think we're seeing some of this happen today where jobs get transformed into new jobs, where, you know, just imagine that, let's say, for example, you're driving a truck and, autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars are, almost there. I think there's still some tweaking that needs to be done, but they're almost there. And so one could imagine that you'll think, oh, my goodness, we'll never have people driving cars anymore. And for trucks that rumble from the West Coast to the East Coast or wherever in the world, you won't have drivers. But just imagine those would be, you'd need other skills. You need people that maybe an IT technician or an IT expert, in the truck, making sure that all the IT and support systems are working well, making sure that there are fail-safe models, making sure that when you come to areas where the AI or machine learning doesn't quite cut it, I can imagine that, if you're trying to, I've tried to drive a Vespa, a scooter, on the small streets of Moradabad in near Delhi in India, and I promise you, I don't think that you can have any machine learning technology do a self-driving car or something on the streets of Moradabad, where any random molecule or a particle or a biological entity is coming from every which direction. It's insane, and so I think you'll need people for that. But I think you'll need more people who are generalists that can do driving as well as some other stuff. So I do see that jobs will transform into newer jobs, which is why this whole concept of upskilling and reskilling is so important in marketing. A lot of the kind of marketing we did earlier has now transformed to digital marketing. Analytics has taken off. And so today, data science teams of companies have grown. They do machine learning, data science, statistics, and so on. And those teams are becoming bigger. So even as certain kinds of teams are diminishing, you see the burgeoning of IT teams, you see burgeoning of data science teams. And I think the same kind of trend will keep happening. I mean, look at computing. when data centers went away to the cloud, people said, "Oh my God, so many jobs will be lost." But guess what? There's more jobs in computer science, more jobs in data centers. You know, we need the ops people. We need ops support people that understand how to do load balancing and security and privacy and all of that stuff. So really, jobs get transformed, and you know, you need new kinds of skills or adjacent skills that people have to really become expert on.
It's interesting. One of the examples that was given to me recently, which made a lot of sense, was, you know, something like online commerce. We imagine, I mean, it has in some ways disrupted a lot of place-based retail, but it didn't remove, although maybe machine learning and robotics might change some of it, but still someone is picking things, putting them in a basket, and actually it has created the new job of bringing it that last mile to someone's door, which wasn't there before because no one had the expectation that they would be able to click a few things on an app and then their groceries show up at their door, or you know, the book they want to buy shows up there at the door, you know, within 24 hours. But it is going to be interesting. I hope that we create more jobs, and actually the jobs are even higher value. But there is this notion of technology as hyper productive, which means that you can get the same output with less labor. So, but my gut sense is edX and Khan Academy, we got a role to play to make sure that most of the jobs are going to be higher up the value chain, more kind of knowledge economy jobs. And so we need to make sure more people are prepared to be there in this world we're going to. You know,
I think what's interesting here, Sal, is that I actually see, this maybe goes back to quantum mechanics. You know, I see sort of a cyclic thing happening here, where as we think we are climbing up the ladder and learning the newer and higher tech skills, what we're also seeing within enterprises is that more and more employees and companies are doubling down on kind of, you know, what they call soft skills. Really, it's better to call them power skills or human skills, where empathy and teamwork and collaboration, creativity, you know, design thinking, empathy, these are all becoming a lot more important, where machines don't quite do that. And so I think we will see kind of a going kind of back to the future approach, where, or maybe more like, you know, future to the past or whatever, where the human skills will be emphasized, where whether in companies or in teaching and so on, the human skills will be emphasized, where people can do what they're good at, which is being human.
I couldn't agree more. I think there's just something about technology, and as we get some of our material needs met by more and more productive technology, we realize that some of these core ideas that we've had for hundreds of thousands of years of human history, the community, being part of a village, being part of a clan, being part of a tribe, that we've gone through a first phase of technology kind of separating us, and we see it. Anxiety, depression, loneliness are really epidemics, and disproportionately epidemic, it seems, in the Western, more materially successful world. And I hope you're right, that as more things get automated, we start realizing, hey, that frees us up to kind of be the humans in the village and connect with each other and emotionally. You know, people talk about healthcare. There's probably going to be a lot of jobs, and just make sure people have companionship. Make sure, you know, there's a lot of studies that the best doctors, who cares what the medicine they're giving is, does the patient feel like they're being heard? Do they feel like they're being cared for? So, this does go back to the quantum physics and Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj around perception is often reality, and this feeling of connectedness. A feeling is a real thing that we can't understate.
Exactly.
Well, this got way more philosophical than I had expected. I thought we were just going to talk about democratizing education, which is a big idea in of itself. But, you know, you have a lot of folks, young people, people of all ages. You know, I mean, I'll let you take us home, Anand. Where is all this going? Where do you hope this goes? What advice should be people's takeaways?
You know, I think it's very simple. Khan Academy, edX, and so on have been doing online learning. You know, you've been doing it for, oh my God, 15 years. We've been doing it at edX for about 10 years. And we began doing this well before the pandemic. But then the pandemic hit about a year ago, and the whole world went to online learning and online working, remote work. I think this is here to stay. I think the one message I have for everybody is that the future is going to be blended, where whether you're in school or college, there's going to be a combination of online learning and in-person learning, where people figure out what are the best things to do online, what are the best things to do in person. So, for example, lectures. Isn't it better to sit in front of a you know, watch short videos, and I call them Khan style videos, 5-10 minute videos that you can pause, rewind as many times as you want, and you can do it at midnight. Isn't that so much better than going to a lecture for 60 minutes and worse 90 minutes at 8 o'clock in the morning? And those things are better done online. However, certain other things, like maybe collaborating with a couple of dorm mates on a problem set, or building something, or you know, working one-on-one with a professor, some of these things might be better done online. And I think we'll figure out the blended model. So to me, my last message is that, you know, if when you're in school, and I would focus on making sure that you learn how to learn, not just in person, but also learn how to learn online. And we actually launched a couple of courses on edX on how to learn online. This will be a very critical skill going ahead, because in the future, all learning will be a combination of online and in-person learning.
I love it. I couldn't agree more. We always have a good time chatting. Anand, Professor Agarwal, thank you so much for joining us, and I'm excited to go on this journey with you, because I think it could make a big dent in the universe.
Well, fantastic, Sal. Always great chatting with you. You've been an inspiration. I would not have been doing this had it not been for the work that you did. And so, just keep up all that you do, and hope we continue to collaborate and do great things in the future.
If you want to hear more of Homeroom with Sal or Khan Academy Ed Talks, subscribe to this podcast and tell a friend. If you want to support the work we do here at Khan Academy, visit khanacademy.org/donate. We're a nonprofit, and we appreciate your financial support in making sure that our materials can reach as many learners as possible. That's khanacademy.org/donate. That's our podcast, folks. Your host is Sal Khan. This show is produced by my wonderful Khan Academy co-workers, Kevin Dangor, Stephanie Yamkovenko, Dan Tu, Irene Wang, Anthony Nelson, Felipe Escamilla, Irene Chen, Ken Jones, Fail Lundberg, and me, David Reinstrom. Our intro theme is Time Flux by Revolution Void, and our outro theme is Onward by Poddington Bear.